Oh, he would have a bad month or two waiting for some government agent to show up and question him about a certain document that had been found in a safety deposit box rented to Kurt Dusander, a.k.a. Arthur Denker. But after a time, the boy would come to believe he had been telling the truth. There was no need for the boy to be touched by any of this as long as he kept his head. Dusander reached out with a hand that seemed to stretch for miles, got the glass of water and took another three pills. He put the glass back, closed his eyes, and settled deeper into his soft, soft pillow. He had never felt so much like sleeping, and his sleep would be long. It would be restful, unless there were dreams. The thought shocked him. Dreams? Please, God, no. Not those dreams. Not for eternity. Not with all possibility of awakening gone. Not in sudden terror he tried to struggle awake. It seemed that hands were reaching eagerly up out of the bed to grab him. Hands with hungry fingers. No! His thoughts broke up in a steepening spiral of darkness, and he rode down that spiral as if down a greased slide, down and down to whatever dreams there are. His overdose was discovered at 1:35 a.m., and he was pronounced dead 15 minutes later. The nurse on duty was young and had been susceptible to elderly Mr. Denker's slightly ironic courtliness. She burst into tears. She was a Catholic, and she could not understand why such a sweet old man, who had been getting better, would want to do such a thing and damn his immortal soul to hell. 26. On Saturday morning in the Bowden household, nobody got up until at least 9. This morning at 9:30, Todd and his father were reading at the table, and Monica, who was a slow waker, served them scrambled eggs, juice, and coffee without speaking, still half in her dreams. Todd was reading a paperback science fiction novel, and Dick was absorbed in Architectural Digest when the paper slapped against the door. "Want me to get it, Dad?" "I will." Dick brought it in, started to sip his coffee, and then choked on it as he got a look at the front page. "Dick, what's wrong?" Monica asked, hurrying toward him. Dick coughed out coffee that had gone down the wrong pipe, and while Todd looked at him over the top of the paperback in mild wonder, Monica started to pound him on the back. On the third stroke, her eyes fell to the paper's headline, and she stopped in mid-stroke as if playing statues. Her eyes widened until it seemed they might actually fall out onto the table. "Holy God up in heaven," Dick Bowden managed in a choked voice. "Isn't that... I can't believe..." Monica began, and then stopped. She looked at Todd. "Oh, honey." His father was looking at him, too. Alarmed now, Todd came around the table. "What's the matter?" "Mr. Denker," Dick said. It was all he could manage. Todd read the headline and understood everything. In dark letters it read, "Fugitive Nazi commits suicide in Santo Donato Hospital." Below were two photos, side by side. Todd had seen both of them before. One showed Arthur Denker, 6 years younger and spryer. Todd knew it had been taken by a hippie street photographer and that the old man had bought it only to make sure it didn't fall into the wrong hands by chance. The other photo showed an SS officer named Kurt Dusander behind his desk at Patton, his cap cocked to one side. If they had the photograph the hippie had taken, they had been in his house. Todd skimmed the article, his mind whizzing frantically. No mention of the winos, but the bodies would be found. And when they were, it would be a worldwide story. Patton Commandant never lost his touch. Horror in Nazi's basement. He never stopped killing. Todd Bowden swayed on his feet. Far away, echoing, he heard his mother cry sharply, "Catch him, Dick, he's fainting!" The word fainting, fainting, fainting repeated itself over and over. He dimly felt his father's arms grab him. And then, for a little while, Todd felt nothing, heard nothing at all. 27. Ed French was eating a Danish when he unfolded the paper. He coughed, made a strange gagging sound, and spat dismembered pastry all over the table. "Eddie," Sandra French said with some alarm. "Are you okay?" "Daddy's choking, Daddy's choking," little Norma proclaimed with nervous good humor, and then happily joined her mother in slamming Ed on the back. Ed barely felt the blows. He was still goggling down at the newspaper. "What's wrong, Eddie?" Sandra asked again. "Him! Him!" Ed shouted, stabbing his finger down at the paper so hard that his fingernail tore all the way through the A section. "That man! Lord Peter! What in God's name are you That's Todd Bowden's grandfather!" "What? That war criminal? Eddie, that's crazy!" "But it's him," Ed almost moaned. "Jesus Christ almighty, that's him!" Sandra French looked at the picture long and fixedly. "He doesn't look like Peter Whimsey at all," she said finally. 28. Todd, pale as window glass, sat on a couch between his mother and father. Opposite them was a graying, polite police detective named Richler. Todd's father had offered to call the police, but Todd had done it himself, his voice cracking through the registers as it had done when he was 14. He finished his recital. It hadn't taken long. He spoke with a mechanical colorlessness that scared the hell out of Monica. He was 17, true enough, but he was still a boy in so many ways. This was going to scar him forever. "I read him, oh, I don't know, Tom Jones, The Mill on the Floss, that was a boring one. I didn't think we'd ever get through it. Some stories by Hawthorne. I remember he especially liked The Great Stone Face and Young Goodman Brown. He started the Pickwick Papers, but he didn't like it. He said Dickens could only be funny when he was being serious, and Pickwick was only kittenish. That was his word, kittenish. We got along the best with Tom Jones. We both liked that one." "And that was 3 years ago," Richler said. "Yes. I kept stopping in to see him when I got the chance. But in high school, we were bussed across town, and some of the kids got up a scratch ball team. There was more homework. You know, things just came up." "You had less time." "Less time, that's right. The work in high school was a lot harder, making the grades to get into college. But Todd is a very apt pupil," Monica said almost automatically. "He graduated salutatorian. We were so proud." "I'll bet you were," Richler said with a warm smile. "I've got two boys in Fairview, down in the valley, and they're just about able to keep their sports eligibility." He turned back to Todd. "You didn't read him any more books after you started high school?" "No. Once in a while I'd read him the paper. I'd come over and he'd ask me what the headlines were. He was interested in Watergate when that was going on, and he always wanted to know about the stock market, and the print on that page used to drive him batshit. Sorry, Mom." She patted his hand. "I don't know why he was interested in the stocks, but he was. He had a few stocks," Richler said. "That's how he was getting by. He also had 5 different sets of IDs salted around the house. He was a cagey one, all right." "I suppose he kept the stocks in a safe deposit box somewhere," Todd remarked. "Pardon me?" Richler raised his eyebrows. "His stocks," Todd said. His father, who had also looked puzzled, now looked at Richler. "His stock certificates, the few that were left, were in a footlocker under his bed," Richler said, "along with that photo of him as Denker." "Did he have a safety deposit box, son? Did he ever say he did?" Todd thought, and then shook his head. "I just thought that was where you kept your stocks. I don't know. This whole thing is just, you know, it blows my wheels." He shook his head in a dazed way that was perfectly real. He really was dazed. Yet, little by little, he felt his instinct of self-preservation surfacing. He felt a growing alertness and the first stirrings of confidence. If Dusander had really taken a safety deposit box in which to store his insurance document, wouldn't he have transferred his remaining stock certificates there, and that photograph? "We're working with the Israelis on this," Richler said, "in a very unofficial way. I'd be grateful if you didn't mention that, if you decide to see any press people. They're real professionals. There's a man named Weisskopf who'd like to talk to you tomorrow, Todd, if that's okay by you and your folks." "I guess so," Todd said, but he felt a touch of atavistic dread at the thought of being sniffed over by the same hounds that had chased Dusander for the last half of his life. Dusander had had a healthy respect for them, and Todd knew he would do well to keep that in mind. "Mr. and Mrs. Bowden, do you have any objections to Todd seeing Mr. Weisskopf?" "Well, not if Todd doesn't," Dick Bowden said. "I'd like to be present, though. I've read about these Mossad characters." "Weisskopf isn't Mossad. He's what the Israelis call a special operative. In fact, he teaches Yiddish literature and English grammar. Also, he's written 2 novels," Richler smiled. Dick raised a hand, dismissing it. Whatever he is, I'm not going to let him badger Todd. From what I've read, these fellows can be a little too professional. Maybe he's okay. But I want you and this Weisskopf to remember that Todd tried to help that old man. He was flying under false colors, but Todd didn't know that. That's okay, Dad, Todd said with a wan smile. I just want you to help us all that you can, Richler said. I appreciate your concern, Mr. Bowden. I think you're going to find that Weisskopf is a pleasant, low-pressure kind of guy. I've finished my own questions, but I'll break a little ground by telling you what the Israelis are most interested in. Todd was with Dusander when he had the heart attack that landed him in the hospital. He asked me to come over and read him a letter, Todd said. We know. Richler leaned forward, elbows on his knees, tie swinging out to form a plumb line to the floor. The Israelis want to know about that letter. Dusander was a big fish, but he wasn't the last one in the lake. Or so Sam Weisskopf says, and I believe him. They think Dusander might have known about a lot of the other fish. Most of those still alive are probably in South America, but there may be others in a dozen countries, including the United States. Did you know they collared a man who had been an Unterkommandant at Buchenwald in the lobby of a Tel Aviv hotel? Really? Monica said, her eyes widening. Really? Richler nodded. 2 years ago. The point is just that the Israelis think the letter Dusander wanted Todd to read might have been from one of those other fish. Maybe they're right, maybe they're wrong. Either way, they want to know. Todd, who had gone back to Dusander's house and burned the letter, said, I'd help you, or this Weisskopf, if I could, Lieutenant Richler, but the letter was in German. It was really tough to read. I felt like a fool. Mr. Denker, Dusander kept getting more excited and asking me to spell the words he couldn't understand because of my, you know, pronunciation. But I guess he was following all right. I remember once he laughed and said, yes, yes, that is what you do, isn't it? Then he said something in German. This was about 2 or 3 minutes before he had the heart attack. Something about Dummkopf. That means stupid in German, I think. He was looking at Richler uncertainly, inwardly quite pleased with this lie. Richler was nodding. Yeah, we understand that the letter was in German. The admitting doctor heard the story from you and corroborated it. But the letter itself, Todd, do you remember what happened to it? Here it is, Todd thought. The crunch. I guess it was still on the table when the ambulance came. When we all left. I couldn't testify to it in court, but I think there was a letter on the table, Dick said. I picked something up and glanced at it. Airmail stationery, I think, but I didn't notice it was written in German. Then it should still be there, Richler said. That's what we can't figure out. It's not? Dick said. I mean, it wasn't? It wasn't, and it isn't. Maybe somebody broke in, Monica suggested. There would have been no need to break in, Richler said. In the confusion of getting him out, the house was never locked. Dusander himself never thought to ask someone to lock up, apparently. His latchkey was still in the pocket of his pants when he died. His house was unlocked from the time the med-Q attendants wheeled him out until we sealed it this morning at 2:30 a.m. Well, there you are, Dick said. No, Todd said. I see what's bugging Lieutenant Richler. Oh, yes, he saw it very well. You'd have to be blind to miss it. Why would a burglar steal nothing but a letter? Especially one written in German. It doesn't listen. Mr. Denker didn't have much to steal, but a guy who broke in could find something better than that. You got it all right, Richler said. Not bad. Todd used to want to be a detective when he grew up, Monica said, and ruffled Todd's hair a bit. Since he had gotten big, he seemed to object to that, but right now he didn't seem to mind. God, she hated to see him looking so pale. I guess he's changed his mind to history these days. History is a good field, Richler said. You can be an investigative historian. Have you ever read Josephine Tay? No, sir. Doesn't matter. I just wish my boys had some ambition greater than seeing the Angels win the pennant this year. Todd offered a wan smile and said nothing. Richler turned serious again. Anyway, I'll tell you the theory we're going on. We figure that someone, probably right here in Santo Donato, knew who and what Dusander was. Really? Dick said. Oh, yes. Someone who knew the truth. Maybe another fugitive Nazi. I know that sounds like Robert Ludlum's stuff, but who would have thought there was even one fugitive Nazi in a quiet little suburb like this? And when Dusander was taken to the hospital, we think that Mr. X scooted over to the house and got that incriminating letter. And that by now it's so many decomposing ashes floating around in the sewer system. That doesn't make much sense either, Todd said. Why not, Todd? Well, if Dusander had an old buddy from the camps, or just an old Nazi buddy, why did he bother to have me come over and read him that letter? I mean, if you could have heard him correcting me and stuff, at least this old Nazi buddy you're talking about would know how to speak German. A good point. Except maybe this other fellow is in a wheelchair, or blind. For all we know, it might be Bormann himself, and he doesn't even dare go out and show his face. Guys that are blind or in wheelchairs aren't that good at scooting out to get letters, Todd said. Richler looked admiring again. True, but a blind man could steal a letter, even if he couldn't read it, though, or hire it done. Todd thought this over and nodded, but he shrugged at the same time to show how far-fetched he thought the idea. Richler had progressed far beyond Robert Ludlum and into the land of Saxe-Rohmer. But how far-fetched the idea was or wasn't didn't matter one fucking little bit, did it? No. What mattered was that Richler was still sniffing around, and that Sheeny Weisskopf was also sniffing around. The letter. The goddamn letter. Dusander's stupid goddamn idea, and suddenly he was thinking of his 3030 cased and resting on its shelf in the cool, dark garage. He pulled his mind away from it quickly. The palms of his hands had gone damp. Did Dusander have any friends that you knew of? Richler was asking. Friends? No, there used to be a cleaning lady, but she moved away and he didn't bother to get another one. In the summer he hired a kid to mow his lawn, but I don't think he'd gotten one this year. The grass is pretty long, isn't it? Yes. We've knocked on a lot of doors, and it doesn't seem as if he'd hired anyone. Did he get phone calls? Sure, Todd said offhandedly. Here was a gleam of light, a possible escape hatch that was relatively safe. Dusander's phone had actually rung only half a dozen times or so, and all the time Todd had known him. Salesman, a polling organization asking about breakfast foods, the rest wrong numbers. He only had the phone in case he got sick. As he finally had, might his soul rot in hell, he used to get a call or two every week. "Did he speak German on those occasions?" Richler asked quickly. He seemed excited. "No," Todd said, suddenly cautious. He didn't like Richler's excitement. There was something wrong about it, something dangerous. He felt sure of it, and suddenly Todd had to work furiously to keep himself from breaking out in a sweat. He didn't talk much at all. I remember that a couple of times he said things like, "The boy who reads to me is here right now. I'll call you back." "I'll bet that's it," Richler said, whacking his palms on his thighs. "I bet 2 weeks' pay that was the guy." He closed his notebook with a snap. So far as Todd could see, he had done nothing but doodle in it, and stood up. "I want to thank all three of you for your time, you in particular, Todd. I know all of this has been a hell of a shock to you, but it'll be over soon. We're going to turn the house upside down this afternoon, cellar to attic, and then back down to the cellar again. We're bringing in all the special teams. We may find some trace of Dusander's phone mate yet." "I hope so," Todd said. Richler shook hands all around and left. Dick asked Todd if he felt like going out back and hitting the badminton birdie around till lunch. Todd said he didn't feel much like badminton or lunch, and went upstairs with his head down and his shoulders slumped. His parents exchanged sympathetic, troubled glances. Todd lay down on his bed, stared at the ceiling, and thought about his 30-30. He could see it very clearly in his mind's eye. He thought about shoving the blued steel barrel right up Betty Trask's slimy Jewish coos. Just what she needed, a prick that never went soft. "How do you like it, Betty?" he heard himself asking her. "You just tell me if you get enough, okay?" He imagined her screams, and at last a terrible flat smile came to his face. "Sure, just tell me, you bitch. Okay? Okay? Okay?" "So what do you think?" Weisskopf asked Richler when Richler picked him up at a luncheonette 3 blocks from the Bowden home. "Oh, I think the kid was in on it somehow," Richler said. "Some way, to some degree. But is he cool? If you poured hot water into his mouth, I think he'd spit out ice cubes. I tripped him up a couple of times, but I've got nothing I could use in court. And if I'd gone much further, some smart lawyer might be able to get him off on entrapment a year or two down the road, even if something does pull together. I mean, the courts are still going to look at him as a juvenile. The kid's only 17. In some ways, I guess he hasn't really been a juvenile since he was maybe 8. He's creepy, man." Richler stuck a cigarette in his mouth and laughed. The laugh had a shaky sound. "I mean, really fucking creepy." "What slips did he make?" "The phone calls, that's the main thing. When I slipped him the idea, I could see his eyes light up like a pinball machine." Richler turned left and wheeled the nondescript Chevy Nova down the freeway entrance ramp. 200 yards to their right was the slope, and the dead tree where Todd had dry-fired his rifle at the freeway traffic one Saturday morning not long ago. He's saying to himself, this cop is off the wall if he thinks Dusander had a Nazi friend here in town, but if he does think that, then it takes me off ground zero. So he says, yeah, Dusander got one or two calls a week, very mysterious, I can't talk now, Z5, call later, that type of thing. But Dusander's been getting a special quiet phone rate for the last 7 years, almost no activity at all and no long distance. He wasn't getting a call or two a week. What else? He immediately jumped to the conclusion that the letter was gone and nothing else. He knew that was the only thing missing because he was the one who went back and took it. Richler jammed his cigarette out in the ashtray. We think the letter was just a prop. We think that Dusander had the heart attack while he was trying to bury that body. The freshest body. There was dirt on his shoes and his cuffs, and so that's a pretty fair assumption. That means he called the kid after he had the heart attack, not before. He crawls upstairs and phones the kid. The kid flips out as much as he ever flips out, anyway, and cooks up the letter, a story on the spur of the moment. It's not great, but not that bad either, considering the circumstances. He goes over there and cleans up Dusander's mess for him. Now the kid is in fucking overdrive. Med-Q's coming, his father is coming, and he needs that letter for stage dressing. He goes upstairs and breaks open that box. You've got confirmation on that? Weisskopf asked, lighting a cigarette of his own. It was an unfiltered player, and to Richler it smelled like horseshit. No wonder the British Empire fell, he thought, if they started smoking cigarettes like that. Yes, we've got confirmation right up the yin-yang, Richler said. There are fingerprints on the box which match those in his school records, but his fingerprints are on almost everything in the goddamn house. Still, if you confront him with all that, you can rattle him, Weisskopf said. Oh, listen, hey, you don't know this kid. When I said he was cool, I meant it. He'd say Dusander asked him to fetch the box once or twice so he could put something in it or take something out of it. His fingerprints are on the shovel. He'd say he used it to plant a rose bush in the backyard. Richler took out his cigarettes, but the pack was empty. Weisskopf offered him a player. Richler took one puff and began coughing. They taste as bad as they smell, he choked. Like those hamburgers we had for lunch yesterday, Weisskopf said, smiling. Those Macburgers. Big Macs, Richler said and laughed. Okay, so cross-cultural pollination doesn't always work. His smile faded. He looks so clean-cut, you know? Yes. This is no J.D. from Vasco with hair down to his asshole and chains on his motorcycle boots. No. Weisskopf stared at the traffic all around them and was very glad he wasn't driving. He's just a boy, a white boy from a good home. And I find it difficult to believe that. I thought you had them ready to handle rifles and grenades by the time they were 18 in Israel. Yes, but he was 14 when all of this started. Why would a 14-year-old boy mix himself up with such a man as Dusander? I have tried and tried to understand that, and still I can't. I'd settle for how, Richler said, and flicked the cigarette out the window. It was giving him a headache. Perhaps if it did happen, it was just luck. A coincidence. Serendipity. I think there is a black serendipity as well as white. I don't know what you're talking about, Richler said gloomily. All I know is the kid is creepier than a bug under a rock. What I'm saying is simple. Any other boy would have been more than happy to tell his parents or the police. To say, I have recognized a wanted man. He is living at this address, yes, I am sure, and then let the authorities take over. Or do you feel I am wrong? No, I wouldn't say so. The kid would be in the limelight for a few days. Most kids would dig that. Picture in the paper, an interview on the evening news, probably a school assembly award for good citizenship, Richler laughed. Hell, the kid would probably get a shot on real people. What's that? Never mind, Richler said. He had to raise his voice slightly because 10-wheelers were passing the Nova on either side. Weisskopf looked nervously from one to the other. You don't want to know. But you're right about most kids. Most kids. But not this kid, Weisskopf said. This boy, probably by dumb luck alone, penetrates Dusander's cover, yet instead of going to his parents or the authorities, he goes to Dusander. Why? You say you don't care, but I think you do. I think it haunts you, just as it does me. Not blackmail, Richler said, that's for sure. That kid's got everything a kid could want. There was a dune buggy in the garage, not to mention an elephant gun on the wall. And even if he wanted to squeeze Dusander just for the thrill of it, Dusander was practically unsqueezable except for those few stocks he didn't have a pot to piss in. How sure are you that the boy doesn't know you found the bodies? Oh, I'm sure. Maybe I'll go back this afternoon and hit him with that. Right now it looks like our best shot. Richler struck the steering wheel lightly. If all of this had come out even one day sooner, I think I would have tried for a search warrant. The clothes the boy was wearing that night? Yeah. If we could have found soil samples on his clothes that matched the dirt in Dusander's cellar, I almost think we could break him. But the clothes he was wearing that night have probably been washed 6 times since then. What about the other dead winos, the ones your police department has been finding around the city? Those belong to Dan Bozeman. I don't think there's any connection anyhow. Dusander just wasn't that strong, and more to the point, he had such a neat little racket already worked out. Promise him a drink and a meal, take him home on the city bus, the fucking city bus, and waste him right in his kitchen. Weisskopf said quietly, it wasn't Dusander I was thinking of. What do you mean by the... Richler began, and then his mouth snapped suddenly closed. There was a long, unbelieving moment of silence, broken only by the drone of the traffic all around them. Then Richler said softly, Hey, come on now, give me a fucking br- As an agent of my government, I am only interested in Bowden because of what, if anything, he may know about Dusander's remaining contacts with the Nazi underground. But as a human being, I am becoming more and more interested in the boy himself. I'd like to know what makes him tick. I want to know why. And as I try to answer that question to my own satisfaction, I find that more and more I am asking myself, what else? But do you suppose, I ask myself, that the very atrocities in which Dusander took part formed the basis of some attraction between them? That's an unholy idea, I tell myself. The things that happen in those camps still have power enough to make the stomach flutter with nausea. I feel that way myself, although the only close relative I ever had in the camps was my grandfather, and he died when I was 3. But maybe there is something about what the Germans did that exercises a deadly fascination over us, something that opens the catacombs of the imagination. Maybe part of our dread and horror comes from a secret knowledge that under the right or wrong set of circumstances, we ourselves would be willing to build such places and staff them. Black serendipity. Maybe we know that under the right set of circumstances, the things that live in the catacombs would be glad to crawl out. And what do you think they would look like? Like mad Führers with forelocks and shoe-polished mustaches hiling all over the place? Like red devils or demons or the dragon that floats on its stinking reptile wings? I don't know, Richler said. I think most of them would look like ordinary accountants, Weisskopf said. Little mind men with graphs and flowcharts and electronic calculators, all ready to start maximizing the kill ratio so that the next time they could perhaps kill 20 or 30 millions instead of only 6. And some of them might look like Todd Bowden. You're damn near as creepy as he is, Richler said. Weisskopf nodded. It's a creepy subject. Finding those dead men and animals in Dusander's cellar, that was creepy, huh? We ever thought that maybe this boy began with a simple interest in the camps? An interest not much different from the interest of boys who collect coins or stamps, or who like to read about Wild West desperados? And that he went to Dusander to get his information straight from the horse's head? Mouth, Richler said automatically. Man, at this point I could believe anything. Maybe, Weisskopf muttered. It was almost lost in the roar of another 10-wheeler passing them. Budweiser was printed on the side in letters 6 feet tall. What an amazing country, Weisskopf thought, and lit a fresh cigarette. They don't understand how we can live surrounded by half-mad Arabs, but if I lived here for 2 years, I would have a nervous breakdown. Maybe. And maybe it isn't possible to stand close to murder piled on murder and not be touched by it. 29. The short guy who entered the squad room brought stench after him like a wake. He smelled like rotten bananas and wild root cream oil and cockroach shit in the inside of a city garbage truck at the end of a busy morning. He was dressed in a pair of aging herringbone pants, a ripped gray institutional shirt, and a faded blue warm-up jacket from which most of the zipper hung loose, like a string of pygmy teeth. The uppers of his shoes were bound to the lowers with crazy glue, a pestiferous hat sat on his head. "Oh, Christ, get out of here," the duty sergeant cried. "You're not under arrest, Hap. I swear to God, I swear it on my mother's name. Get out of here. I want to breathe again." "I want to talk to Lieutenant Bozeman." "He died, Hap. It happened yesterday. We're all really fucked up over it, so get out and let us mourn in peace." "I want to talk to Lieutenant Bozeman," Hap said more loudly. His breath drifted fragrantly from his mouth, a juicy, fermenting mixture of pizza, Hall's mentholyptus lozenges, and sweet red wine. "He had to go to Siam on a case, Hap. So why don't you just get out of here, go someplace and eat a light bulb?
"I want to talk to Lieutenant Bozeman, and I ain't leaving until I do."
The duty sergeant fled the room. He returned about 5 minutes later with Bozeman, a thin, slightly stooped man of 50. "Take him into your office, okay, Dan?" the duty sergeant begged. "Won't that be all right?" "Come on, Hap," Bozeman said. And a minute later they were in the three-sided stall that was Bozeman's office. Bozeman prudently opened his only window and turned on his fan before sitting down. "Do something for you, Hap?"
"You still on those murders, Lieutenant Bozeman?"
"The derelicts? Yeah, I guess that's still mine."
"Well, I know who greased them."
"Is that so, Hap?" Bozeman asked. He was busy lighting his pipe. He rarely smoked the pipe, but neither the fan nor the open window was quite enough to overwhelm Hap's smell. Soon, Bozeman thought, the paint would begin to blister and peel. He sighed.
"You remember I told you Paulie was talking to a guy just the day before they found him all cut up in that pipe? You remember me telling you that, Lieutenant Bozeman?"
"I remember." Several of the winos who hung around the Salvation Army and the soup kitchen a few blocks away had told a similar story about two of the murdered derelicts, Charles Sonny Brackett and Peter Poley Smith. They had seen a guy hanging around, a young guy talking to Sonny and Poley. Nobody knew for sure if Sonny had gone off with the guy, but Hap and two others claimed to have seen Poley Smith walk off with him. They had the idea that the guy was underage and willing to spring for a bottle of muskie in exchange for some juice. Several other winos claimed to have seen a guy like that around. The description of this guy was superb, bound to stand up in court, coming as it did from such unimpeachable sources. Young, blonde, and white. What else did you need to make a bust?
"Well, last night I was in the park," Hap said, "and I just happened to have this old bunch of newspapers. There's a law against vagrancy in this city, Hap. I was just collecting them up,"
Hap said righteously.
"It's so awful the way people litter. I was doing a public service, Lieutenant, a friggin' public service. Some of those papers was a week old."
"Yes, Hap," Bozeman said. He remembered vaguely being quite hungry and looking forward keenly to his lunch. That time seemed long ago now.
"When I woke up, one of those papers had blew onto my face, and I was looking right at the guy. Gave me a hell of a jump, I can tell you. Look, this is the guy. This guy right here."
Hap pulled a crumpled, yellowed, water-spotted sheet of newspaper from his warm-up jacket and unfolded it. Bozeman leaned forward, now moderately interested. Hap put the paper on his desk so he could read the headline. Four boys named to Southern Cal All-Stars. Below the head were four photos. "Which one, Hap?" Hap put a grimy finger on the picture to the far right.
"Him. It says his name is Todd Bowden."
Bozeman looked from the picture to Hap, wondering how many of Hap's brain cells were still unfried and in some kind of working order, after 20 years of being sautéed in a bubbling sauce of cheap wine seasoned with an occasional shot of Sterno. "How can you be sure, Hap? He's wearing a baseball cap in the picture. I can't tell if he's got blonde hair or not."
"The grin," Hap said. "It's the way he's grinning. He was grinning at Poley in just that same ain't-life-grand way when they walked off together. I couldn't mistake that grin in a million years. That's him. That's the guy."
Bozeman barely heard this last. He was thinking and thinking hard. Todd Bowden. There was something very familiar about that name, something that bothered him even worse than the thought that a local high school hero might be going around and offing winos. He thought he had heard that name just this morning in conversation. He frowned, trying to remember where. Hap was gone, and Dan Bozeman was still trying to figure it out when Richler and Weisskopf came in. And it was the sound of their voices as they got coffee in the squad room that finally brought it home to him. "Holy God," said Lieutenant Bozeman, and got up in a hurry. 30. Both of his parents had offered to cancel their afternoon plans, Monica at the market and Dick golfing with some business people, and stay home with him. But Todd told them he would rather be alone. He thought he would just clean his rifle and just sort of think the whole thing over, try to get it straight in his mind. "Todd," Dick said, and suddenly found he had nothing much to say. He supposed if it had been his own father he would have at this point advised prayer, but the generations had turned, and the Bowdens weren't much into that these days. "Sometimes these things happen," he finished lamely, because Todd was still looking at him. "Try not to brood about it." "It'll be all right," Todd said. After they were gone, he took some rags and a bottle of alpaca gun oil out onto the bench beside the roses. He went back into the garage and got the .30-30. He took it to the bench and broke it down, the dusty sweet smell of the flowers lingering pleasantly in his nose. He cleaned the gun thoroughly, humming a tune as he did it, sometimes whistling a snatch between his teeth. Then he put the gun together again. He could just as easily have done it in the dark. His mind wandered free. When it came back, some 5 minutes later, he observed that he had loaded the gun. The idea of target shooting didn't much appeal, not today, but he had still loaded it. He told himself he didn't know why. "Sure you do, Todd, baby. The time, so to speak, has come." And that was when the shiny yellow Saab turned into the driveway. The man who got out was vaguely familiar to Todd, but it wasn't until he slammed the car door and started to walk toward him that Todd saw the sneakers. Low-topped Keds, light blue. Talk about blasts from the past. Here, walking up the Bowden driveway, was Rubber Ed French, the Ked man. "Hi, Todd. Long time no see." Todd leaned the rifle against the side of the bench and offered his wide and winsome grin. "Hi, Mr. French. What are you doing out here on the wild side of town? Are your folks home?" "Gee, no. Did you want them for something?" "No," Ed French said after a long, thoughtful pause. "No, I guess not. I guess maybe it would be better if just you and I talked, for starters, anyway. You may be able to offer a perfectly reasonable explanation for all this, although God knows I doubt it." He reached into his hip pocket and brought out a news clipping. Todd knew what it was even before Rubber Ed passed it to him, and for the second time that day he was looking at the side-by-side pictures of Dusander. The one the street photographer had taken had been circled in black ink. The meaning was clear enough to Todd. French had recognized Todd's grandfather. And now he wanted to tell everyone in the world all about it. He wanted to midwife the good news, good old Rubber Ed, with his jive talk and his motherfucking sneakers. The police would be very interested, but of course they already were. He knew that now. The sinking feeling had begun about 30 minutes after Richler left. It was as if he had been riding high in a balloon filled with happy gas. Then a cold steel arrow had ripped through the balloon's fabric, and now it was sinking steadily. The phone calls, that was the biggie. Richler had trotted that out just as slick as warm owl shit. "Sure," he had said, practically breaking his neck to rush into the trap. "He gets one or two calls a week. Let them go ranting all over Southern California looking for geriatric ex-Nazis. Fine. Except maybe they had gotten a different story from Ma Bell. Todd didn't know if the phone company could tell how much your phone got used. But there had been a look in Richler's eyes. Then there was the letter. He had inadvertently told Richler that the house hadn't been burgled, and Richler had no doubt gone away thinking that the only way Todd could have known that was if he had been back, as he had been not just once but 3 times, first to get the letter and twice more looking for anything incriminating. There had been nothing. Even the SS uniform was gone, disposed of by Dusander sometime during the last 4 years. And then there were the bodies. Richler had never mentioned the bodies. At first Todd had thought that was good. Let them hunt a little longer while he got his own head, not to mention his story, straight. No fear about the dirt that had gotten on his clothes burying the body. They had all been cleaned later that same night. He ran them through the washer-dryer himself, perfectly aware that Dusander might die and then everything might come out. "You can't be too careful, boy," as Dusander himself would have said. Then, little by little, he had realized it was not good. The weather had been warm, and the warm weather always made the cellar smell worse. On his last trip to Dusander's house, it had been a rank presence. Surely the police would have been interested in that smell and would have tracked it to its source. So why had Richler withheld the information? Was he saving it for later? Saving it for a nasty little surprise? And if Richler was into planning nasty little surprises, it could only mean that he suspected. Todd looked up from the clipping and saw that Rubber Ed had half turned away from him. He was looking into the street, although not much was happening out there. Richler could suspect, but suspicion was the best he could do. Unless there was some sort of concrete evidence binding Todd to the old man. Exactly the sort of evidence Rubber Ed French could give. Ridiculous man, in a pair of ridiculous sneakers. Such a ridiculous man hardly deserved to live. Todd touched the barrel of the 30-30. Yes, Rubber Ed was a link they didn't have. They could never prove that Todd had been an accessory to one of Dusander's murders. But with Rubber Ed's testimony, they could prove conspiracy. And would even that end it? Oh, no. They would get his high school graduation picture next. and start showing it to the stew-bums down in the Mission District. A long shot, but one Richler could ill afford not to play. If we can't pin one bunch of winos on him, maybe we can get him for the other bunch. What next? Court next. His father would get him a wonderful bunch of lawyers, of course, and the lawyers would get him off, of course. Too much circumstantial evidence. He would make too favorable an impression on the jury. But by then his life would be ruined anyway, just as Deucander had said it would be. It would all be dragged through the newspapers, dug up and brought into the light, like the half-decayed bodies in Deucander's cellar. "The man in that picture is the man who came to my office when you were in the 9th grade, Ed told him, abruptly turning to Todd again. "He purported to be your grandfather. Now it turns out he was a wanted war criminal." "Yes," Todd said. His face had gone oddly blank. It was the face of a department store dummy. All the healthiness, life, and vivacity had drained from it. What was left was frightening in its vacuous emptiness. "How did it happen?" Ed asked, and perhaps he intended his question as a thundering accusation, but it came out sounding plaintive and lost and somehow cheated. "How did this happen, Todd?" "Oh, one thing just followed another," Todd said, and picked up the 30-30. "That's really how it happened. One thing just followed another." He pushed the safety catch to the off position with his thumb and pointed the rifle at Rubber Ed. "As stupid as it sounds, that's just what happened. That's all there was to it." "Todd," Ed said, his eyes widening. He took a step backwards. "Todd, you don't want to... Please, Todd, we can talk this over. We can just... You and the fucking Kraut can discuss it down in hell," Todd said, and pulled the trigger. The sound of the shot rolled away in the hot and windless quiet of the afternoon. Ed French was flung back against his sob. His hand groped behind him and tore off a windshield wiper. He stared at it foolishly as the blood spread on his blue turtleneck, and then he dropped it and looked at Todd. "Norma," he whispered. "Okay," Todd said. "Whatever you say, champ." He shot Rubber Ed again, and roughly half of his head disappeared in a spray of blood and bone. Ed turned drunkenly and began to grope toward the driver's side door, speaking his daughter's name over and over again in a choked and failing voice. Todd shot him again, aiming for the base of the spine, and Ed fell down. His feet drummed briefly on the gravel and then were still. Sure did die hard for a guidance counselor, Todd thought, and brief laughter escaped him. At the same moment, a burst of pain as sharp as an ice pick drove into his brain, and he closed his eyes. When he opened them again, he felt better than he had in months, maybe better than he had felt in years. Everything was fine. Everything was together. The blankness left his face, and a kind of wild beauty filled it. He went back into the garage and got all the shells he had, better than 400 rounds. He put them in his old knapsack and shouldered it. When he came back out into the sunshine, he was smiling excitedly, his eyes dancing. It was the way boys smile on their birthdays, on Christmas, on the 4th of July. It was a smile that betokened skyrockets, treehouses, secret signs, and secret meeting places. The aftermath of the triumphal big game when the players are carried out of the stadium and into town on the shoulders of the exultant fans. The ecstatic smile of tow-headed boys going off to war in coal-scuttle helmets. "I'm King of the world," he shouted mightily at the high blue sky, and raised the rifle two-handed over his head for a moment. Then, switching it to his right hand, he started toward that place above the freeway where the land fell away and where the dead tree would give him shelter. It was 5 hours later, and almost dark, before they took him down.
The End. You've been listening to Apt Pupil, From Different Seasons, by Stephen King. Narrated by Frank Muller. Enjoy the other 3 seasons of the year as Different Seasons continues in The Body, again narrated by Frank Muller. You'll find The Body, unabridged, on cassette, in the Recorded Books catalog. We carry a wide selection of titles, including bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more. So to order another recorded book, or for a copy of our latest listing, call us toll-free, nationwide, at 1-800-638-1304, or fax us at 301-535-5499. You can order by phone with Visa or MasterCard, or by writing to us at Recorded Books Incorporated, P.O. Box 409, Charlotte Hall, Maryland, 20622. Don't forget to ask about 30-day rentals. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.